Welcome to the Gila Membres Community Radio Show, Earth Matters, which brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. We aim to inform, challenge, engage, and inspire our listeners. Three hosts alternate weekly shows to bring the listener to a broad range of topics and expertise. My name is Nathan Newcomer, the Gila Grassroots Organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and I'm your host for today's show. The New Mexico Wilderness Alliance is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the protection, restoration, and continued enjoyment of New Mexico's wild lands and wilderness areas. Today's show is about the Mexican Gray Wolf Program and the recent developments in newly proposed rule changes and how the public can get involved. My guest today is Dave Parsons, who represents the Rewilding Institute as its carnivore conservation biologist. Dave served as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's first Mexican Wolf Recovery Coordinator from 1990 to 1999 and was the primary author of the original rule that established a non-essential experimental population of the Mexican gray wolf in Arizona and New Mexico. Mr. Parsons has continued to follow the progress of the Mexican Wolf Recovery Program from his retirement from the Fish and Wildlife Service in 1999 to the present day. He holds a Bachelor's of Science and a Master's of Science degree in Wildlife Biology, served as a career wildlife biologist for the Fish and Wildlife Service for 24 years, and has lectured nationally and internationally on wolf biology, ecology, and conservation. Welcome to Earth Matters, Dave.
Thank you, Nathan. I'm happy to be here.
Well, first of all, Dave, if we can just briefly tell us a little bit about your experience working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for 24 years.
Well, I won't go into too much detail on that. I was worked in a variety of programs, but later on in my career for the last 10 years, I had the opportunity to get into the Endangered Species Program and the special opportunity to take a position to run the Mexican Wolf Recovery Program from its inception, basically, and starting in 1990. I ran that program for 9 years. Most of that was involved in developing proposals and running those through public review and EISs and all of those things you have to do to get something done these days and federal agencies. And by 1998, we were fortunate to get the nod from then Secretary Bruce Babbitt to go ahead with our first releases in the Apache National Forest over in Arizona. And that year we turned the first 11 wolves in three different family groups loose into the wild. Those would have been the first wolves to experience the wild in the Southwest for on the order of 50 years or so.
And so now we're in a place where the Fish and Wildlife Service is going to be doing some proposed rule changes. Whether they actually have, they have issued a proposed rule changes that's open to draft public comment right now. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes, there have been some significant changes in policy. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing to take all gray wolves in the lower 48 states, with the exception of the Mexican wolf, off of the endangered species list. So everywhere else in the country, wolves will come under the management of the states in which they reside. In order to salvage the Mexican wolf, I guess you might say, from that process, they have to go through a separate relisting process to put the Mexican wolf subspecies, which is Canis lupus baleyi, back on the endangered species list as the only endangered gray wolf in the country. And to do that, they have to issue a new rule, because the one I wrote doesn't apply to this new listing. So while they're at it, they're making a bunch of changes, but unfortunately, most of the changes are taking the program in the wrong direction.
Well, Dave, tell us a little bit about some of those changes and what you think the public really needs to be aware of as it pertains to the national delisting effort of the gray wolf and why the agency is having to go through the effort of relisting the Mexican gray wolf once they've delisted the gray wolf proper.
Right. Well, it gets a little bit into the weeds of the listing process, but I'll try to be brief. Back in 1976, the Fish and Wildlife Service was in the business of listing gray wolves one subspecies at a time, and that's when the Mexican wolf was originally listed. Then in 1978, they decided that it made more sense to just list the species as a whole across the entire lower 48 states. So they changed the listing to Canis lupus without recognizing subspecies. But in the language of that rule, they said they would still recognize subspecies for recovery purposes. So the recovery of the Mexican wolf continued under that umbrella listing of gray wolf. Recovery plan was written in 1982, and that was the basis for the original reintroductions in 1998. Since they're delisting Canis lupus and Baleei, the Mexican wolf falls under that, they would be delisting Baleei with it unless they went through the process of relisting the Mexican wolf. So that's why we're in this kind of convoluted policy situation.
Sounds very convoluted. So what's your take on this proposed rule change that the Fish and Wildlife Service has out? And I believe that the public comment period has been extended to October 28th?
That's correct. It's still out for comment until October 28th. There are several problems with it. One is that they have made some assumptions about what the new rule would be prior to going through the, I'll just call it the EIS process.
It's the Environmental Impact
National Statement. Environmental Policy Act, which requires environmental review of any proposal like this. And they're just now starting the EIS process, and there's another opportunity out that closes on September 19th to have input into what they call scoping for that EIS. And in the scoping phase, they're supposed to leave all options on the table, and they're already assuming, for example, that the relisting of the Mexican wolf would be under a special provision that would be classified as non-essential experimental population. Now, we used that classification back in 1998, but we didn't have any wolves in the wild at the time.
And today we have about 75, is that right?
Now, today we have 75 at last count. And so that, if you read the language of the Endangered Species Act, that word non-essential means non-essential to the continued existence of the species in the wild. Well, back then we didn't have any Mexican wolves in the wild. And so even though it was the political preference, it still made a little bit of sense to use that classification because we'd never tried reintroducing Mexican wolves before. But now we have the only wild population in existence, and it's grown to 75 wolves. And we know from some preliminary recovery planning efforts that eventually we're going to need as many as three or more populations of wolves, and they need to be interconnected with linkages that allow dispersal between these populations. And we know from habitat suitability studies that have been published in peer-reviewed literature that the area we chose for the first release, which we call the Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area, simply that's the Gila National Forest in Arizona, or I'm sorry, in New Mexico, and the Apache National Forest, mostly in Arizona. So those two forests combined are the Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area. That area has been shown repeatedly in more recent habitat suitability studies to still be one of the best places for recovering Mexican wolves. So it is essential to the continued existence of the species in the wild, and so that would be an argument for not continuing to use the non-essential experimental population status.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. Having the Mexican gray wolf listed as a non-essential experimental population seems a little backwards to me. And it seems to me that would be one key change that we would try to be pushing for in the new proposed rule changes, is transferring that non-essential to an essential population. Do you find that that will be something difficult for us to get, or is that something that the agency is just not willing to budge on?
Well, heretofore they've not been willing to budge on it, but the provision is there in the Act, and I'm certainly making a case in my comments for why the non-essential classification can no longer be supported by the best available science. And that's the key. All decisions for listing populations under the Endangered Species Act are supposed to be supported by the best available science and are supposed to be immune from any politics that might be pushing decisions in a different direction. And we've seen, particularly through some disclosures recently, that there appears to be a fair bit of politics at play in both the national delisting and the Mexican wolf relisting proposals. So I've laid out a case in my comments for why I believe the best available science supports a listing of at least essential. It really probably should support just a straight out listing as endangered, which doesn't allow any provisions for mitigating conflict, but there's certainly potential for conflict out there, and that could be handled just as easily under a classification of essential rather than non-essential. Now, there's one key difference that comes into play between those two classifications. And under non-essential, federal agencies other than the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service essentially get off the hook for having to do anything on their own to promote the recovery of that species. They can simply say, well, if it's non-essential to the continued existence of that species in the wild, then whatever we do doesn't matter, because we can go back to the captive population, for example, which is the argument, and reestablish a wild population. But under the essential classification, a key provision elsewhere in the Act, it really gets wonky, but Section 7A2 requires all other federal agencies other than the Fish and Wildlife Service to consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service on any activity that might jeopardize the existence of a listed species in the wild. So it would force a formal review by other agencies, particularly the Forest Service, of all the things they propose to do on the forest with regard to what effect it might have on endangered Mexican wolves. And it would force the Fish and Wildlife Service to work with the Forest Service on writing what's called a biological opinion, which looks at what's being proposed and assesses the impacts of what it might have on a listed species. So, kind of long-winded, but that's how these things work.
Well, imagine that, actually forcing the two agencies that need to work together on the issues that need to be done and taken care of. So the essential population sounds like it's one key component for the proposed rule changes that needs to be changed. There's obviously a couple other things that you have a take on this. Can you give us an idea briefly, before we go to a break, on some of the other key aspects of the proposed rule changes?
Yes. One key aspect is that because the Fish and Wildlife Service has stalled twice now on getting recovery teams up and going and getting a set of recovery criteria that makes sense today with today's science, they're still basing this proposal on the 1982 recovery plan, which self-admits that it's just a starting point for recovery and does not lay out a full path to recovery. It only requires one population of 100 wolves or so in the area we chose now, the Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area. It speaks to a second population, but it starts with the first one. And so everything the service is proposing right now is based on a population limit of roughly 100 wolves in the Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area. And we know through modern science that that's not even close to being recovery, and in fact, a single population that size is not sustainable over the long term. Yet they fail to recognize the science that has emerged from ongoing but currently suspended recovery planning efforts, and maybe we're pushing the brake, but I could get into some of that right now or a little later.
Yeah, we'll take a break right now, and we'll be right back with Dave Parsons with the Rewilding Institute and its Conover Conservation Biologists. You are listening to Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio. Welcome back to the Gila Members Community Radio Show, Earth Matters, which brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. I'm Nathan Newcomer, the Gila Grassroots Organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and I'm your host for today's show. With us today is Dave Parsons, the Carnivore Conservation Biologist for the Rewilding Institute. Welcome back, Dave.
Thanks, Nathan.
So we were just getting into some of the other aspects of the proposed rule change that the Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing for the Mexican Gray Wolf Program. And we left it off last talking about the 1982 recovery plan, which basically said that the goal of the program was to establish one population of approximately 100 wolves in the Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area, and that the Fish and Wildlife Service is still essentially relying on this 1982 plan to guide them in moving forward with the new plan some 30 years later. Is that right?
That's exactly right. It's a real problem because it's hard to argue that science that goes back to 1982 is the best available science since 2013. And in fact, there's been a good deal of science that has taken place since then and been published in peer-reviewed journals, and there's been a lot of work by science teams that have been appointed to two different Mexican wolf recovery teams that have been either abandoned or suspended for reasons that the Fish and Wildlife Service really hasn't articulated very well. A team was convened in 2003 and worked for 2 years and then abandoned in 2005 after the science team had been working on developing criteria for full recovery. That team had reached at least a preliminary conclusion that full recovery would require at least three populations of Mexican gray wolves, separate populations but linked by migration corridors or dispersal corridors. It require management of the genetics because they come from a very small founding base. Mexican wolves got down to seven animals that were rescued in captivity and bred back to about 250 animals now in captivity and the 75 we have in the wild. The reason for abandoning that team is not clear, but that's what happened. Then in 2010, the Fish and Wildlife Service convened a new recovery team, appointed a new science group whose primary purpose on a recovery team is to review the best available science and make recommendations for what full recovery needs to look like. And that science team had worked throughout 2011 and had, the last time we met, which was November of 2011, I sit on another team called the stakeholder team on that recovery team. The scientists presented their draft recommendations for what full recovery should look like, and it involved three populations of averaging 250 wolves each, with no population being less than 200 wolves, and connectivity between and genetic management and all the same sort of issues, which hadn't changed. And for whatever reason, from that date forward, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has suspended all further meetings of that team. And for whatever reasons, certain members of the stakeholder group on that team chose to leak that draft report from the science team. In fact, a member of the Arizona Game Commission at one of their public meetings copied and distributed that draft document to the public. Now, we had all sworn to a confidentiality agreement for serving on the team, and that we were not supposed to share draft documents until they were ready for public review. But that agreement was breached by a number of folks on that stakeholder group. So the document is out, and it's been picked up and distributed additionally by the organization called PEER, which is Public Employees for Environmental Review. And that science is out, and in fact, that science has informed at least one now peer-reviewed journal article, and others are in the works. So I make the argument in my comments that that is the best available science. The Fish and Wildlife Service has known about it for some time because they've been receiving draft reports from this science group, and that it cannot be ignored at this point, and that any proposed rule that they put forward has to, at a minimum, not foreclose any future recovery activity that might flow from a recovery plan whenever they get around to finishing that job.
So this wolf recovery team that you just talked about, they were working with the Fish and Wildlife Service on basically producing a report that they weren't supposed to make available to the public, but it was, as you said, leaked out to the public, and now everybody can see it and can read it. Do you know that if that document had not been leaked out to the public, that the Fish and Wildlife Service actually would have taken that information and made it a part of this new proposed rule change?
Well, let me clarify that a little bit. The Fish and Wildlife Service is required under the Endangered Species Act to develop recovery plans for all listed endangered species. And they're also required to upgrade those recovery plans. And so they were, you know, this was an effort to upgrade the 1982 recovery plan. They actually select who they want on a recovery team, and there were four groups in this case. There was the scientists, who are supposed to be immune from politics and following the best available science, which our science team did. And then a group of stakeholders who are supposed to eventually look at the recommendations from the science team and figure out the best way to apply that on the ground. And then there were tribal representatives, and there was yet another group that's escaping me at the moment, but agency representatives, like state agencies and such. So we were in mid-process, and following the standard process for recovery planning, which is the team meets several times and receives reports initially from the science team as to what they're finding needs to be done to recover species. And we had reviewed one round of that, and we're waiting, expecting the next meeting to be the one where we actually adopted the final set of criteria for what recovery should look like. Then the Fish and Wildlife Service would assemble a larger document containing that science that would be the draft recovery plan, and that would go out to public review. So, you know, this information got leaked at a what you might call a pre-decisional stage. We had not actually adopted those standards yet officially within the team.
So we should probably be thankful to a couple of people over in Arizona, I'm assuming.
Well, in a way, yeah. I think maybe it didn't work out the way they had planned, because now that information is out there, and it really can't be ignored.
And about that information, it sounds like you, I don't want to say you fully endorse it, but it's got good, the best available science in it. Is that right?
It's what the science team believes is the best available science. I believe they've come out a bit on the minimum side of things and haven't left a lot of room for risk factors or what we call the precautionary principle. When you know, you're running models and you get a range of outputs, and they tended to move toward the lower end of those ranges and not leaving much of a buffer for getting it wrong, so to speak. But they're well within the parameters of the information they reviewed and the models they ran and such. I would have liked the numbers to be a little higher, but and they may well could have been had we been allowed to complete the process. But
right.
Now those numbers have been out, and everybody's sort of working from those numbers as being the numbers that we'll see in a recovery plan, if we ever get a recovery plan. So to review that a little bit, the proposed rule is kind of capping the population at 100, because that's what was in the 82 plan. These new criteria say three populations averaging 250, but no population of less than 200. So what I did in my comments was to look at, let's suppose there are two populations that are 200, and that means that one population has to be capable of being at least 350. And since we only have one population and we've only identified one reintroduction area at this point, or recovery area, we have to assume that that area might be the current wolf recovery area. So I'm arguing that they establish a population goal in this rule of at least 350 wolves for this, what we call a Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area, and they're proposing actually a couple of good things. One is they're proposing to expand that area to make it larger by adding on more Forest Service districts around the periphery of it, and that would be a good thing. It would give us more room to grow wolves and more room to put wolves out in the wild. And the other thing they're doing is eliminating a purely a politically driven policy back in 1998 that where the Fish and Wildlife Service said it would not release wolves over the objection of a state, and the state of New Mexico objected, so we were only allowed to release wolves on the Arizona side of the line, which is only about a fourth of that whole reintroduction area. So this rule would open the whole thing up for releases of wolves from captivity.
So that's two really great things, it sounds like. They want to expand the Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area, and then they're going to allow, or they're proposing to allow, the direct release of Mexican wolves into New Mexico as opposed to just in Arizona?
That's right.
And how much larger is this proposed expansion of the recovery area? And would it, in your opinion, Dave, be large enough to support the three populations that you were talking about of 250 wolves?
Well, the answer to the last question is no. This is just enlarging the what would be one population of the three.
I see.
Which would be, we'll probably still call it the Blue Range population. Studies have shown that the existing area may be capable of holding up to 350 wolves. Some of the carrying capacity estimates go up to almost 400 wolves. But just to be safe, and it would be nice to have the area a little larger to help us get to that number of 350 wolves. Then what would happen is if they use an experimental population classification, which they most surely will, and we hope it's going to be essential rather than non-essential, they will buffer that area with another area called the Mexican Wolf Experimental Population Area and allow wolves to disperse out into that, and that is another very good thing. The problem with the current proposed rule is that it would stop wolves and require their capture and return at I-40 to the north and Interstate 10 to the south. And some of the areas under consideration by the recovery team, two of them lie north of I-40, up around the Arizona-Utah line and the New Mexico-Colorado line. So this proposal would actually foreclose the option of wolves walking their way and dispersing into new areas of suitable habitat to aid recovery, and require that those areas use reintroduction like we did, which is a pretty hard way to go. And that would foreclose future recovery options by drawing, again, hard lines on the boundary. Initially, those hard lines were around just the introduction area itself, which are the two national forests, and now they're going to draw them a little further out, but it's kind of like it's going from a small box to a larger box and still setting up barriers for wolves.
Which we know will not obey those boundary lines.
No, they don't.
We've been talking with Dave Parsons, carnivore conservation biologist for the Rewilding Institute. We're going to take a quick break. This is the Gila Membranous Community Radio Show, Earth Matters. Welcome back to the Gila Membranous Community Radio Show, Earth Matters, which brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. I'm your host, Nathan Newcomer, the Gila grassroots organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. And with us today is Dave Parsons, the carnivore conservation biologist for the Rewilding Institute. Welcome back, Dave.
Thank you.
Earlier we were talking about the Mexican gray wolf being put back on the endangered species list. And do you see any conflicts if that happens in the context of the proposed rule changes?
Actually, there's one significant conflict that arises there. The language for in the proposed rule for relisting the Mexican gray wolf says that it would be classified as endangered throughout the Southwest wherever it is found. And that's a key term, wherever found is what it says. So any place a Mexican wolf would show up, unless it had been given a special classification like they're trying to do for the Blue Range population of non-essential experimental, it would be endangered. So if it went outside those boundaries, it would be endangered. But the Fish and Wildlife Service has made those, again, hard boundaries with a capture and return requirement for any wolf that crosses the line. So no wolf in the wild would ever get the chance to be endangered, or nor would it get the chance to disperse to other areas that might be suitable and have been shown to be suitable for achieving full recovery of the subspecies. So it does two things. It actually doesn't allow Mexican wolves to choose of their own volition where they're found. It essentially imposes a restriction on Mexican wolves and says you can only be found inside these lines, because if we find you outside, we're going to bring you back or put you back in captivity. So that's a real problem. It precludes the opportunity for Mexican wolves to choose the only places they would choose to live, and it forecloses future recovery options that we know, and the Fish and Wildlife Service has actually admitted to in that listing document, that there needs to be at least three populations and there needs to be connectivity between them. So they're kind of contradicting even their own science they've revealed in that listing document.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that, because if the Mexican gray wolf is indeed listed as an endangered species again, and it says that they're endangered throughout the Southwest wherever they are found, it sounds like the proposed rule then is trumping the Endangered Species Act in a way. Is that right?
Well, it's the proposed rule derives from a special section in the Endangered Species Act. So it's not trumping per se, but the provisions in it are certainly in conflict with the proposed relisting of the wolf, and they're in conflict with what everybody knows future recovery criteria would look like. What we've done in our comments on the rule, and I hope they'll listen to us, is we've asked simply that if they choose to use the experimental classification, we've asked that they do it as essential experimental, and they can still create a boundary of where that would apply, but we've asked them to eliminate the capture and return provision and allow wolves to disperse wherever they choose to. They have other ways that they can manage wolves, so to speak, outside that line, even if they have full endangered status. But those wolves would receive more protection, actually, out there, and they would be the wolves that are moving out to establish potentially new populations that we know are needed for full recovery.
So, Dave, the boundaries that we've been talking about in the proposed rule changes, you said that it would go as far north as I-40 and then as far south as I-10, correct?
Right.
How far?
That's what they call their proposed alternative.
How far east would it go?
Well, that would be within the states of Arizona and New Mexico.
Oh, so it would go broad all the way across the state. Wow, okay.
Right. Now, there's not suitable wolf habitat in all that country, obviously.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so in your mind, in order for us to get to a stage, I mean, we're sort of at like baby steps, it seems like, at this point, but in your mind, where do we need to be in terms of to get the three populations of 250 wolves in each, different areas? How big does this boundary really need to be to actually be successful and actually ensure that the Mexican gray wolf continues to roam free and wild?
Yeah, well, the answer is to not have a boundary and to base recovery on areas suitable for recovering Mexican wolves, wherever those are, and allow wolves the opportunity to either walk there or allow the Fish and Wildlife Service the opportunity without having to go back later and change rules all over again to reintroduce wolves in areas that are deemed suitable for recovery, wherever they might be. That's one answer. I guess I'll leave it there for now.
Well, I like the way you think. So moving forward with the proposed rule, we've talked a lot about this. You've given us some great information, Dave. We really do appreciate it. I want folks to know where they can go to get more information or even to get some of the information that we've talked about today, like the Wolf Recovery Team, their report that came out that was leaked out. Is there a specific hub, maybe on the internet or anywhere else that people can go to get this information that we've been discussing today?
Well, a good source and a source that would provide some of the information I've been providing today would be a website called MexicanWolves.org, and it's the website of an organization called Lobos of the Southwest. And it's you can see a list of the groups that support that website. There's current content there on what's going on with Mexican wolves and what's going on with these review processes. One of the things you'll find there is that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service just recently announced that it would be holding a public hearing on this national delisting of gray wolves and the relisting of Mexican wolves and the proposed rule for classifying those relisted Mexican wolves as non-essential experimental in the wild. All of those things will be on the table at a public hearing in Albuquerque on October 4th. And that hearing, I believe, starts at 6 o'clock, but there would be information on MexicanWolves.org about that.
Okay.
So there's also a comment period open, which we talked about earlier, on both of those. All three of those things are open for comments until October 28th.
Okay, so just to recap, we've got a public hearing that's coming up October 4th in Albuquerque. Folks can get information on location, time at MexicanWolves.org, and we've also got the public comment period still open until October 28th for the public to comment on the proposed revision to the non-essential experimental population of the Mexican gray wolf.
And they can also comment on the national delisting of all gray wolves and the relisting of the Mexican gray wolf. Both of those are rolled into one document that's unfortunately like 250 pages long, but it's available online in the Federal Register, as is the proposed rule. Now, just so people aren't intimidated by that, the part of that bigger delisting that addresses the Mexican wolf is much shorter, if that's what you're interested in.
So, Dave, if you could, maybe this might be asking a tall order, but if you could just summarize for us sort of the main talking points for our listeners out there, if they really wanted to get involved and submit comments to the Fish and Wildlife Service, if you could give us just a couple of quick bullet points, what would those key elements be for the public to send into the Fish and Wildlife Service as it pertains to this issue?
Well, I think one key would be that the proposed rule provides recommendations that are ahead of the decision chain. The parlance in a court of law would be pre-decisional to the National Environmental Policy Act process, which is supposed to be open right now to all ideas. And they're putting forth some pretty specific ideas, in particular that they would be using the non-essential experimental classification, and they do not even entertain any of the proposed alternatives that they have out there. They don't entertain the idea of going to essential experimental. In fact, they spend a great deal of effort in that document explaining why non-essential experimental is still a valid classification. So that's one key issue. So the second point would be that the public could make is that the proposed rule for reclassifying Mexican gray wolves as non-essential experimental is flawed by the fact that it's based on a 1982 recovery plan and not based on the best available science. that science we talked about earlier in the show comes from work by teams of nationally renowned wolf scientists and conservation biologists on two past recovery teams. It's been leaked out now to the public, and the information is out there. The Fish and Wildlife Service has essentially acknowledged that in the document to relist the Mexican wolf. So that needs to be the basis for this proposed rule. Another point is that the target population, if you want to call it that, for this rule needs to be increased well above 100, which was based on the 82 plan again, and it needs to be at least 350 wolves based on the best science that's available. Another is that the wolves need to be allowed to disperse wherever they choose to go and not, again, penned in by hard boundaries and with rules for capturing and returning them when they cross that line. That's probably a good set of issues from my point of view.
We appreciate that, Dave. We've been talking with Dave Parsons, the carnivore conservation biologist with the Rewilding Institute. I'm Nathan Newcomer, your host for this episode of Earth Matters on Gila Membres Community Radio Show. We will be right back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Gila Membres Community Radio Show, Earth Matters, which brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. I'm your host today, Nathan Newcomer, the Gila Grassroots Organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. And with us today, we have Dave Parsons, the Carnivore Conservation Biologist for the Rewilding Institute. Thanks for joining us from Albuquerque today. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground, and there's still a little bit more ground to cover. I noticed within the last couple of weeks that there was a couple of settlements that had been agreed to from some lawsuits that I believe the Center for Biological Diversity was a part of. Dave, can you talk to us a little bit about those settlement agreements and what they mean for the future of the Mexican gray wolf?
Yes, I don't know the exact details, but I know what they mean. And the lawsuits had to do with the Fish and Wildlife Service essentially dragging their feet on getting these things done, particularly a change in the rule to allow wolves to be released anywhere within the reintroduction area. And that lawsuit was not adjudicated by the court, but rather settled between the parties, and the Fish and Wildlife Service agreed to finish this proposed rule for reclassifying Mexican wolves and the relisting of the Mexican wolves and the environmental impact process that goes along with that by no later than sometime in January of 2015. So now we have a court-enforced date certain to know that we'll finally get this done, and we'll have a new set of rules that hopefully will allow us to move forward now to full recovery of Mexican wolves.
Dave, I also read somewhere that there was a settlement agreement reached with the Forest Service and Mexico, where if a Mexican gray wolf came up from Mexico and it came into New Mexico, that the Fish and Wildlife Service, rather, would have to then protect that species. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is. There was a permit that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service sort of quietly issued to itself under another provision of the Endangered Species Act called Section 10. Actually, Section 10A, and which allows them to issue permits to allow activities that might promote wolf recovery. And the Fish and Wildlife Service has long believed, even though it's never been proven by scientific study, that if they have the flexibility to manage wolves that come into conflict with various human activities, in particular livestock activities, and can manage those in some way by either hazing or removing wolves, which otherwise wouldn't be allowed under the Endangered Species Act under full endangered, they think and presume that creates tolerance and then in the long run actually moves things forward better for wolf recovery. It's never been proven. In fact, there's some new social science studies coming out that suggest just the opposite, that they're doing those things does not generate increased tolerance. But That aside, they issued this permit to themselves to manage wolves that might disperse out of the small population that's being reintroduced in Mexico and come into the United States in a zone south of I-10 and north of the border, where they would, by default, have full endangered status. Folks who filed a lawsuit somehow got wind of that through a Freedom of Information Act request that this permit was out there, and they argued that it wasn't properly done, it wasn't proposed to the public, and was done quietly, and the Fish and Wildlife Service apparently agreed with this within the settlement agreement that they had done it improperly, so they have rescinded that permit. Now, in the proposed rule and the alternatives that they've put forth for that, they do suggest that they would be doing that permit over again eventually once they establish boundaries as to where a wolf is endangered and where it's experimental. So that's where they are, and in fact, no such permit is in effect right now, so if a wolf walked over from Mexico today and stayed south of I-10, it would have full protection of the Endangered Species Act.
And having wolves coming in from Mexico would be a good thing for the population here in New Mexico because of the genetics. Can you talk a little bit about that issue and how that's sort of playing into the long-term sustainability of the Mexican gray wolf?
Yes, it's an extremely critical issue. Mexican wolves were completely eliminated from the wild by the mid-20th century. And they hung on a little longer in Mexico, but by the time the Mexican wolf was put on the endangered species list in 1976, there were no wolves left, no Mexican wolves left in the United States, and just a few in Mexico. So the Fish and Wildlife Service hired a trapper to go into Mexico. He had been working there already with ranchers and capture alive as many wolves as he could. And between 1978, I believe it was, and 1980, He was able to capture five wolves alive. It was one female who was pregnant and four males. And the Mexican government allowed those wolves to be transferred to breeding facilities in the United States to essentially save the subspecies from extinction. There were later two lines of wolves that were already in captivity but couldn't be verified as to their origin that I had tested for their genetic purity in the mid-90s, and they turned out to be pure wolves. And so there were three wolves from those caught in Mexico and two wolves each from these other populations that existed that were considered founders of all the Mexican wolves that exist today. So seven wolves eventually interbred from three different breeding lines to create all Mexican wolves today. Needless to say, when you go through a genetic bottleneck that tight, you lose a lot of gene diversity, and by losing gene diversity, you have run the risk of issues related to what they call inbreeding depression or a reduction in the fitness of the animals, and some of that's been documented. The captive population has been managed very professionally by a group of professionals that operate under a program called the Species Survival Plan, and that's administered by a national group called the American Zoo and Aquarium Association. They've done the best job they can in preserving the gene diversity in the captive population. The wild side's a little different. Fish and Wildlife Service, because they have not embraced and proposed enough releases over time, in fact, they've released only one new wolf since 2007, has not managed to move the gene diversity of the captive population into the wild. So the wild population right now is fairly significantly inbred and needs a fairly rapid infusion of these wolves in captivity that contain genes from some of these other breeding lines and mixes of those lines that would boost the genetic health of the wild population, and Fish and Wildlife Service has essentially fallen flat on that side of the equation. And a number of folks, and in fact, the the new recovery plan would address that issue, because there's a conservation geneticist who follows all this on that recovery team, and he's made specific recommendations for how to rescue the genetic health of the wild population, but none of that's yet been implemented by the Fish and Wildlife Service to any significant degree.
This sounds like an extremely, extremely difficult problem. Having a good set of genes or a good gene pool with the captive population, and they're just sitting there. Why is it that the Fish and Wildlife Service hasn't been releasing more wolves? You said one wolf has been reintroduced since 2007? That's just astonishing to me.
Yeah, it is. Part of the problem is that the old rule that only allows releases to take place in a part of the recovery area on the Arizona side. So all releases from captivity have to take place there. And some of the better areas for releasing wolves there have wolf packs established in them already. That creates an untenable situation. One of the most recent attempts to release a pair over there last year, or earlier this year actually, was aborted because the wild wolves showed up outside the release pen where the captive wolves were being held, and it's just not something you would do. You don't release a wolf into another wolf's territory because, you know, their territorial defense is one of the best things they do, keeping wolves that aren't a member of their pack out of their territory. So fights would ensue and wolves would probably die. So that's been a problem. Now, you know, there have been recommendations to fix that rule, to allow these range-wide releases starting in 99 and again in 2003 and what was called the three-year review, and again in 2005, which was called the five-year review. All of these have consistently recommended that the rule be modified to allow releases over on the New Mexico side. And why they have not gotten that done until now, which they've proposed, but it won't be done until 2015, is a question that would have to be asked of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Yeah, they are really just dragging their feet, and it's really painful to even hear about it because, like you just said, having a gene pool so small in the wild and having such a diverse array of genes in captivity, they're wasting their time, and it's at the expense of the Mexican gray wolf, and it's really, really a shame to hear.
Yeah. Well, I have recommended in my comments, which I haven't sent yet, but I'm developing, that they look for ways with authorities that they have to maybe do this sooner rather than waiting till 2015. For example, I don't know for sure, but it seems that if they can write a special rule under Section 10 to manage wolves that come in from Mexico, they might be able to write a special permit that would allow them to release wolves in New Mexico to promote the recovery of the species.
That would make
sense.
Things
like that. So yeah. I'd ask them to take a look at whatever authorities they currently have that wouldn't require going through this long process to find a way to put more wolves in more places and mix these genes better.
Well, Dave, we've got about a minute left on our program. Is there anything else that you want to make sure our listeners are aware of before we check out?
Well, one thing that we didn't talk about is the amount of illegal killing that's taking place in the wild population. And it's been pretty significant. I think there have been 46 wolves since the initial releases in 1998 that have been killed illegally, and only four people have actually been prosecuted for that. And the reason the prosecution rate is so low is that the Department of Justice, back early on in the Yellowstone Project, when the first wolf was killed there, a guy was prosecuted and convicted in federal court, and he appealed to his conviction to a higher level appellate court, and they upheld it, and then he appealed to the Supreme Court, and Department of Justice, for whatever reason, didn't want that issue heard in the Supreme Court, so they issued a policy that's known to this day, since the mid-90s, as the McKittrick policy, which says that issues instructions to federal prosecutors around the country that they cannot bring a case against somebody who kills an endangered species unless they can prove that the person who killed it knew that it was an endangered species. In other words, they knew what they were killing. And that's sort of unprecedented in the history of wildlife law in this country, and it's why the federal prosecutors just have their hands tied, basically. If a guy says, well, I thought it was a coyote, then they've got no case.
I'm glad you brought up the McKittrick policy, Dave, because on our next show, I'm going to be interviewing Judy Kalman, who is the staff attorney with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and she has been working on the McKittrick policy, and she'll be able to provide us with a lot more detail next time. For now, this is Nathan Newcomer, the Gila Grassroots Organizer with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. We've been talking with Dave Parsons, the carnivore conservation biologist for the Rewilding Institute, and the man that was behind the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service first Mexican wolf recovery coordination position from 1990 to 1999, and was the primary author of the original rule that established the non-essential experimental population of Mexican gray wolves in Arizona and New Mexico. Dave, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. My pleasure, too.
This has been Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio Show. Thank you for listening, and join us next time.